What makes a great film soundtrack? Great film scores are instantly recognisable, aren't they? We could play the game where I hum a tune. Don't worry, we won't. But we could play the game. I hum the tune. You could guess it. You've probably done that at home. They're instantly recognisable. But obviously it takes more than that to make a great film soundtrack, because Postman Pat is instantly recognisable as well. It doesn't quite count. What makes great film music is that it goes with a great story, right? And a great soundtrack combines with a great story to enhance it for us. Create something powerful. A great soundtrack guides our emotional response to what we're seeing and hearing. It heightens our emotions at a great story. And it works because it matches the story that it's set with. The tune, the words as well. Think about something like Walking in the Air with the Snowman. Zechariah's song that we're looking at this morning works a bit like a soundtrack. Not to a film, but to human history itself. History of the world as it's told in the Bible. Zechariah stands right at the seam between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Part one and part two of the big story. And his song weaves the two together. And it does what great soundtracks do. It enhances our emotional appreciation of the story. It guides us effectively through the Bible's perspective on history. So it's a brilliant thing to look at together, whether we're familiar with the Bible's take on history or not. And there are three features that I want to bring out of Zechariah's song together. Three notes or passages or melodies. Someone more musical can tell me what the right term would have been afterwards. Three notes that his soundtrack hits along the way. Firstly, the epic swell. If you want to know whether a soundtrack is effective, you need to know what kind of film that it accompanies. This film that Zechariah sings about is an epic. I don't know if you're eager to see Star Wars Rogue One over Christmas. Lots of people are. You might not know that that's even coming this Christmas. Star Wars is an epic. It tries to create a sense of epic. They all start with this great big plot summary which scrolls the screen before you see the film. It's all about a long time ago. In a galaxy far, far away, it's about good and evil on a galactic scale. Well, Zechariah's song is that kind of scale. Did you see that? Verse 70. It's about the fulfillment of words spoken long ago. It's about, verse 71, salvation from our enemies. It's about good and evil on a grand scale. It's about, right there at the beginning, verse 68, the God, the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who made the world, rescuing, redeeming his people. Towards the end, it's about, verse 78, the rising sun coming to shine on those living in the shadow of death. And Zechariah himself is standing, as he sings, at the turning point of the whole plot. Zechariah is the first person we meet in Luke's Gospel. So the way that Luke begins his part of the New Testament, the way that Luke begins part two of the story, Zechariah is the first person we meet. In chapter one, he was at the temple. He was doing his duties as a priest when he sees this vision of an angel who says to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife, Elizabeth, will bear you a son. And you'll call his name John, and you'll have joy and gladness. And many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared." Now that's a big opening, that's a big dramatic opening scene. It's an epic twist in an epic tale. It's quite a claim for Zechariah to take in, that he's going to have this significant part in world history. That he, this elderly man with a barren wife, is going to have a son who will play a huge role. So much to take in that Zechariah doesn't believe it. And so the angel says he won't be able to speak until later. And only later, when the child promised has been born. We can read it just over the page from the song in verse 63 of chapter 1. Only when Zechariah indicates by writing down that the child should be called John in obedience to the angel, only then can he speak again. And verse 64, immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue set free, and he began to speak, praising God. And this song that we're looking at, his soundtrack, are what flows out of him at this point. He's praising God with joy, the joy of his child being born, the joy of the promise being fulfilled, which means everything the angel has said about the child must be true. It means, verse 68, the God of Israel has come to his people. The great story is turning. The saga continues. The epic of history, of God's history, is still going on. And it's about to turn around. And Zechariah gives us in his song his own kind of Bible overview. He's a priest, so he spends his time at the temple listening to God's word being taught, teaching the word, performing the rituals set out in the Old Testament. He's an old man, so he's been doing that all his life for years and years. It means the Old Testament story, Old Testament poetry, Old Testament law, it's all in his blood, and it flows out in his song. His song is a recollection of what God said through his holy prophets long ago. The words are stuffed full of Old Testament concepts and phrases and references. Some people have liked to summarize the plot of the Bible like this: God's place, God's people in God's place under God's rule. Can you see those themes in Zechariah's song? It's all about God's people, isn't it? God dealing with people, the creator of the universe, of innumerable worlds, dealing with human beings. He's come to his people and redeemed them. He talks about raising up a horn of salvation for us in the house of David. Zechariah sings about salvation from our enemies, from the hand of all who hate us, showing mercy to our ancestors, keeping the oath he kept to our father Abraham to rescue us from the hand of our enemies and to enable us to serve him, to give his people, verse 77, the knowledge of salvation. God chose out of the world a people, a group of people, Israel, and the Old Testament follows his dealings with that people, how he rescued them out of a land of slavery, into his place, the land of Israel, to live under his rule, under his laws, to serve him and show to the world what it looked like to live under God's rule. That's the story that unfolds through the Old Testament, and yet it unfolds with twists and turns. There were setbacks, there were enemies, as he sings about. The hand of those who hate us. They had been at one point God's people in God's place under God's law, but they had rejected God's law, been thrown out of the land, and when Zechariah sings his song, have every reason to doubt whether they are God's people anymore. So Zechariah is singing this song of this great epic tale, and he's right in the middle of it. There's a great deal of unfinished business in the story. It's not at the end. Although I wonder if that's how it felt like at the time. It's been between the Old and New Testaments, 400 years of, well, nothing really. Nothing significant in the twist of the big story. No prophets, The Roman Empire now ruling the world, looking pretty impervious. I wonder if it's a temptation for every generation to feel like we're living at the end of history. The big twists and turns, they're all in the past. What the Bible talks about is all in the past. 2016 might have been a year of big events, but things like Brexit and President Trump, were they really going to change radically the course of world history? I think we all doubt that. Won't things just go on more or less as they have before? Why did Zechariah doubt the angel who came to you? Yeah, his age, Elizabeth's condition would have been big things to get over. I wonder if maybe even more this question, won't things just go on the same? Won't they just go on as they always have before? But by the time he comes to sing this song, he's come to think very differently. In fact, he thinks everything is going to change. Because the big story of history is God's story. And given what God has already said, it simply cannot be over. Zechariah stands at the seam of the two testaments, the old and the new. He looks backwards and he looks forward. And he shows us that what's about to happen in the New Testament simply must be, if we understand the old rightly. His first line, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel," is a direct echo of 1 Kings 1:48, which says this: when King David sees Solomon ascend to the throne, his son, he says this: "Blessed be, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted someone to sit on my throne this day, my own eyes seeing it." David is rejoicing that God has kept his promise to put his descendant on his throne. And Zechariah knows God has promised there will be always a king in the line of David sitting on the throne. And he picks up these words because he is rejoicing that he is seeing that story continue. He's rejoicing, verse 69, that a horn, someone strong, has been raised up in the house of David, that the story is continuing as it must. He picks up verse 73 as he talks about the oath God swore to Abraham. Another part of the Old Testament, Genesis 22, "By myself I've sworn, declares the Lord, to Abraham, I will surely bless you, and I will multiply your offspring, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies." Zechariah thinks, this is what God has said in the past. He has promised that Abraham's descendants will not be ruled by their enemies. And so where he lives right now, under Roman rule, with the people crushed, that can't be the end. The big story is still going. And today, that big story is still the big story. History today, 2016, is still God's history. It would be tempting for us, perhaps, to think that the Bible talks about everything in the past. But that's not so. Zechariah reminds us it's only the end, when everything is accomplished, that God has promised. If it is not, then just like him, we're living in the middle of an epic. We are not at the same place in the story as Zechariah. He looks forward to things that we now look backwards to. But we're not at the end either. This is how the Bible describes the end of the great story. There'll be no more crying or pain or sadness, and death will be no more. Well, last time I looked, there was still plenty of pain and sadness and crying and death around. How do we respond to the world being like that? Do we say it's just the way it is, always has been, always will be? Not if we have Zechariah's response. The Christian response to that is different. It's that history is not at its end yet. Second note of Zechariah's song I want to pick up on is a jarring clash, a clashing note. You're probably familiar with the common movie plot device, The Chosen One. You've seen that in The Matrix, if you've seen that, or again in Star Wars. It's even in the Lego movie, brilliantly spoofed. The idea that there's this dark situation, but there's an ancient prophecy that the Chosen One will arise to put all things right. Well, arguably, Hollywood has taken that straight from the Old Testament. Maybe we're familiar with the Old Testament expectation of the Chosen One, the Messiah. He's the focal point of all the hopes that Zechariah sings about. He's the horn of salvation in the house of David. The king who's going to be the one who acts to rescue the people, to rid them of their enemies. Zechariah is excited because he believes the Chosen One is here. He's about to arrive. But actually, maybe the surprise is that Zechariah talks not about one, but about two chosen ones. The Messiah, but also his own son, John, verse 76. You, my child, will be called a prophet of the Most High. You'll go on before the Lord to prepare the way for him. Again, he's picking up words from the Old Testament. Isaiah 40, a voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. He echoes part of the prophet Malachi, which says, behold, I'll send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. So there's this expectation that there's a promised one coming and a preparation person who's going to come just before him. I think it's instructive for us to look at John's role and what his job is all about. Why does Zechariah choose to sing about it? Why is it so significant in the great story? Apart from the fact that it's his son. Who is he preparing? Well, verse 77, it seems to be his people. He's preparing the people to give his people knowledge of salvation. It's the people who need to be prepared for the arrival of the Chosen One. How does he prepare them? Again, verse 77, he gives them knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of sins. And that is crucial because it strikes at the heart of why there is an Old and a New Testament. Strikes at the heart of the biggest move in the big story. What's the great problem that needs to be overcome? What's taken the people from God's people in God's place under God's rule to their low place that they're in right now? It is sin. It's wrongdoing. It's evil. It's that they've turned away from God's rule. And John's preparation role is to get the people ready to understand that this turning point in history is all about dealing with sin. People's plight can only be turned around by the forgiveness of sins. And so John's role is to make people aware that they're the problem. They're turning from right to wrong, and that they need forgiveness as the solution. And this is a jarring note in the soundtrack. It's a clash. It's difficult to listen to because it clashes with what we want to hear. And John's work in history was unpopular. We can read about that if we go on in Luke's gospel. He pointed out to the people that they were the problem. And that's not a popular message. Let me tell you, I don't take kindly to people pointing out my flaws, even when they mean it well, even when it's done in love, even when they're trying to help me. Instinctively, my reaction is to reject it. We don't like that kind of help. But it's exactly the note that we need to hear if we want to appreciate this point in history. It's a key note in Zechariah's soundtrack to world history. You want to rightly understand how history has ebbed and flowed and pitched and turned, you're going to have to factor in recognition of human wrong, of guilt, of evil. In fact, you're going to have to reckon on your own guilt. Christians aren't about putting guilt on people, but we absolutely are about owning up to the fact that we all have guilt within. And if we're honest, we know that's necessary. Relationships don't get restored by ignoring problems. It doesn't get fixed by me refusing, being too proud to accept blame. That doesn't work on personal relationships. It doesn't work on a national level either. Could Germany have taken its place in world events after 1945 without accepting responsibility? We need to be prepared. And yet, that's not the response that Zechariah's nation was willing to make. Let's note in the soundtrack, it might clash with our instincts. It clashes even more jarringly with how the story unfolds in Luke's Gospel. Zechariah's song is a song of excitement, isn't it? It's a song of joy. It's a song of welcoming the Chosen One, the Messiah, welcoming the forgiveness of sin that he needs. Zechariah is excited and joyful and welcoming. Israel was not. And here is the jarring, painful gap between the soundtrack and the story. Both of these chosen ones are violently put to death. Here's how one Christian speaker I heard put it. Imagine Zechariah singing his song as you're watching Luke's gospel unfold. Imagine the voice of the old man singing these words, "You, my child, will be called a prophet of the Most High," as John the Baptist's head is put on the block by Herod. Imagine the thin voice of the old man singing, "He's raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David," as the nails are rammed through Jesus' hands and his feet. The clash is almost too much to bear. And yet that point in Luke's gospel of the deepest darkness becomes the stepping point for the steepest soaring. And that's the final note to discern here in Zechariah's song, the triumphant rise. Because the blackest guilt of humankind is the highest point of what Zechariah calls, verse 78, God's tender mercy. Why were this disobedience, this guilt, this evil putting to death the chosen one? Why won't that be the final straw? Why won't that have the same result as every other time in the big story so far? Exile, punishment, and more death. Because this is the tender mercy of God. The cross is God's act of mercy to save and to bring the forgiveness that they needed. There's a way in which mercy is the dominant note through this whole soundtrack. It's explicit here in verse 78, but the sound of it runs the whole way through. Think about how everything moves in the song. The movement in Zechariah's song is all from God to us. He's the one who's come to his people. The rising sun comes to us from heaven. I don't know, the last time you saw the sun rise, it generally tends to be from the earth up into the sky. The rising sun in Zechariah's song comes to us from heaven. John prepares the way before the Lord because the Lord is coming. It's a story, it's a song about God's action to his people and for his people. Out of nothing. There's nothing going on that makes this happen. It comes out of nowhere. Nothing in the past 400 years. The people hadn't changed. Humanity hadn't changed. But God shows up and shows mercy to deal with guilt, to bring forgiveness, and to achieve restoration. Look at verse 74. Look how completely things are going to turn around to enable us to serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. Guilty people who turn from God's law are going to be restored to living in God's place under God's rule, able to serve him in righteousness. That's mercy. That turnaround is God's mercy. And because it's all about God's mercy, the cross isn't the end of the story either. The cross is the means by which God achieves an end that sounds a very different note. It's a note of soaring hope. It's a note that starts with that chosen one, 3 days after his death, proving to his closest friends that he had risen to life again. Do we not want history to have a soundtrack that soars in hope and rises in triumph? Who of us lives in the shadow of death? Don't we all live there? That family trying to have the body of their daughter frozen just after her death a couple of weeks ago. What are they trying to do but avoid the same thing that will come to us all sooner or later? They don't want death. They don't welcome it. We want to live. Death isn't a friend. It's not a natural part of life. It's not a cruel twist in an unfeeling universe that just doesn't care. In the Bible's telling of history, death is a personal power of evil. That is an intruder into God's good world that has come in because of guilt. And the glorious rise of Zechariah's song is that the rising sun has come to shine on those living in the shadow of death, and to shine so brightly that the shadow will be gone forever. You might like to look at the carol we're going to sing at the end, and the third verse that reads like this: Hail the heaven-born Prince of Peace, hail the Son of Righteousness, light and life to all he brings, risen with healing in his wings. Mighty lays his glory by, born that man no more may die, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth. That is the rising, soaring, triumphant note that characterizes how Zechariah views history. We sing that with joy as Christians because that's how we view history. Because of the tender mercy of God, guilt can be taken away, death can be destroyed, and it will be possible to live and serve God without fear all our days, days which will go on for eternity. Mercy is often unwelcome, isn't it? Because, just like John's message, if we are going to accept mercy, we're going to have to acknowledge that we need it. Only for someone who knows they're in trouble can they be thankful when they're spared. The proud heart says, I deserve the good things I get. Don't try and put this on mercy. No one's being kind to me. I've earned it. I deserve it. The humble heart, which is the prepared heart, because none of our hearts are humble by default, the humble heart says, praise be to God for his tender mercy. That's the kind of heart that can sing this song as the soundtrack to history. Zechariah makes us ask the question, what's our read of history? The highs and the lows, the hopes and the fears? How would you set it to music? What would it sound like? I think the options are basically this or something else. Our job, in a sense, this Christmas, if we're Christians, is to invite people to listen. Listen to our soundtrack. Listen to our take on history. There is nothing like this. To anyone ignoring the shadow of death, consider this as an alternative. Consider a reason, a take on history that takes the dark things seriously, and yet whose soundtrack can still soar in triumph. For us ourselves, as Christians, then, we're invited by Zechariah, I think, to indulge this Christmas, not in mince pies and chocolate, but in the swelling gospel sound of his song. Here's something I find interesting. Zechariah starts his song in the past tense. He's looking forward. Jesus hasn't been born yet, but he's so convinced by how inevitable it is, he can talk about it in terms of past achievement. How much more us, looking back on what Zechariah looked forward to. History isn't over, but it has decisively turned, because the Son of Righteousness has risen with healing in his wings.